This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Daphne Farhead of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Monday, Wednesday, Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen live or to past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. And if you go have a Nokia phone, you can also listen live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. I am tremendously pleased to have Naomi Shihab Nye on our show this evening. Naomi is an Arab-American poet extraordinaire. She's won many prestigious awards for her writing, and we will be discussing her work as well as the work of the late Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian national and world-renowned poet who died on August 9th of 2008 after heart surgery at Memorial Hermann Hospital in Houston, Texas. Mahmoud and Naomi were friends. Welcome to the show, Naomi.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
You knew Mahmoud personally, Naomi.
I did, but I knew his poems all my life, and so that adds, you know, it's as if you're better friends with someone than if you just, you know, met them a few times.
I agree. Some of his work has been extraordinary. You said once, Mahmoud Darwish was the essential breath of the Palestinian people, the eloquent witness of exile and belonging. What
yes.
do you see is the value of the statement?
Well, I could see what his voice meant to people like my father. My father was a Palestinian refugee, and I remember when he read some of the first Mahmoud Darwish poems that he had read in Arabic back when I was a teenager. My father said, you know, we need a voice to speak with this beauty and this eloquence for us. You know, a voice can be a country, too. And we need his witness to us, to our experience. And you know, I've felt a tremendous sorrowful silence on the horizon since his death, and I think many Palestinians feel that when you lose your spokesperson, your leader, the person you're so proud of because they're able to captivate others with their, you know, their passion and their mesmerizing images, it's a huge loss. So we all need to keep reading his work, you know, out loud to one another in his memory. And I think Palestinian people have needed that sense of a voice and a witness to experience as much as, you know, all people who suffer great loss, collective loss.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, and his voice did resonate throughout the community. Mahmoud wrote, "I thought poetry could change everything, could change history, and could humanize. And I think that the illusion is very necessary to push poets to be involved and to believe. But now I think that the poetry only changes the poet." What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think he was growing, maybe changing in some of his views about, you know, what everybody gets frustrated as they get older and they see that politics is harder to change than we might hope, and unjust experiences is harder to heal than we might believe when we're very young. And so he was, you know, growing and marinating in the sorrow of you know, ongoing frustration. But I think that a changed poet makes for a changed society. And poets are people of voice. They keep talking wherever they are, even when they, you know, take vows of silence, which poets often do. They end up, you know, probably talking more than anyone. So I think that a changed poet continues to encourage change in thinking. Even if we can't change a law, for example, we can change the way people think about a law or an experience. And so I think that his poems did change many, many people over the years and will continue to. And I do think he did something risky very well, which was to combine his personal aesthetic as a poet and his political tragedy of his life and people, and create a body of work that is huge, that is enduring, that is moving. Today I was receiving messages from Berlin about Darwish poems. I mean, everybody's been getting messages from all over the world. So he's definitely someone who would be considered a world poet, not just a Palestinian poet. And I think that voice will continue speaking for all people who suffer what Palestinian people do suffer.
But now I think that the poetry only changes the poet. Naomi, is that the voice of hopelessness? Do you think that Mahmoud gave up somehow a little bit on an idea of a free Palestine?
I don't think he ever gave up, but I think his dreams were certainly tempered by the realities, which are so frustrating. And I know that, you know, watching my own father, who lived to be 80, he died 11 months ago, and he was also a writer, a journalist, watching his own beliefs and hopes for Palestine shift and change over the years, communicating with great minds like Edward Said and hearing his kind of message about Palestine continue to grow and change as years went on. There's definitely a sort of a disappointment, I think, in humanity that comes over us as we get older. I'm feeling it in the United States right now, and you know, I'm not giving up hope for change, but there's this other part of me that keeps saying, yeah, but look at these other forces. And I think that, you know, Darwish, as he aged, probably, with his expansive consciousness, tried to take into account all those realities of frustration and depression that can be easily associated with a situation such as the truly ridiculous ongoing situation with Palestine and Israel. By the way, can I just throw this in? I've been a Tom Waits fan, the musician Tom Waits, for 35 years, maybe more. I consider myself the hardcore Tom Waits fan, although getting to attend one of his concerts this summer, I realized there are thousands of people who feel the way I do about Tom Waits. And just recently, I listened to one of his songs called On the Road to Peace, which I had never heard before, and it's about the Palestinian-Israeli situation. And Tom Waits does not get political in many of his songs, very few of them. I mean, maybe you'd say a lot of his imagery is, you know, talking about poverty and homelessness is political, but in terms of specific issues, he does not. But I hope everyone will look up the song called On the Road to Peace by the great Tom Waits of California. And one of the questions he asks is, just tell me, you know, with this ongoing cycle and everybody's claimed this land and all the tragedy and all the kids and all the, you know, young people fighting an old man's war, and this is not right, why does the United States keep giving weapons to the Israelis? And he asks that clearly and pointedly in the song. And I just felt so proud of my hero in music that suddenly he has sung a song about the conflict place most profound in my heart all my life.
Well, you know, Palestinians have been made to be wholesale monsters by some of the Zionist community. Do you think that Israel should be prepared to humanize the Palestinians as our poets and humanities community does to Israel? Mahmoud had once written, I will continue to humanize even the enemy. Poetry and beauty are always making peace.
Yes. Yes, I think that's very important. And I think there are so many people in Israel who know that and who work for that with all their might. I'm in touch with a lot of them, and we all are. And so, you know, it's as hard to change kind of the power mongers in Israel as it is to change the power mongers in the United States. So, you know, to shift, to change, to work to a larger consciousness, it's very difficult. And so yes, I do think that that humanizing force of culture and shared art, whatever art it is, you know, I loved how Edward Said and his friend Daniel Barenboim used music to create an exchange among Palestinian and Jewish people, and I think we have to keep trying to do that every way we can.
And can you tell me, why do you think he was considered Palestine's national poet? What was it about Mahmoud that set him aside?
Well, he just, he had the force. I mean, he was the force. He had the voice, the vision, the strength of image. He had the charismatic gift of language. Anyone who hears his voice. Recently, people have been writing emails to me saying, gee, I just looked up Mahmoud Darwish on YouTube for the first time. I had never heard his own voice. And I heard him reading in Arabic, and I don't speak any Arabic, but I am so moved. I'm weeping by his voice. There was some kind of passion, you know, in his voice that you just hear in the greatest masters of poetry, of music, of, you know, that was so essentially profound, and you can recognize that truth in a voice when you hear it, and so many people rallied to it, you know, people who are not necessarily intellectuals, who are not educated, who might not read poetry on a regular basis. For example, when they would hear his poems, they would weep and say, that is my story. Now, I remember my own father, who was, you know, certainly open to poetry, but not a huge, huge poetry fan, feeling that Darwish spoke for him. Darwish told his story. And so there was that collective ability to identify with the imagery in the poems, the invocation, the yearning, the sorrow. And I think his poems were so large by nature that they didn't just go one place. They often tended to be very long poems, and they went many places. They traveled, you know, as the spirit travels through many, many cycles of emotion, even in a single day. You're, you know, depressed in the morning, and you're hopeful in the afternoon, and you're furious in the evening. And his poems would do some of that magic and somehow create the wholeness of the tapestry of being. You know, he spoke for everybody. And I'd love to read a poem of his, if you'd let me, that I included in my first anthology that I ever made. It was way back in the early 90s, a book which I'm happy to say is still in print, called This Same Sky, a collection of poems from around the world. And I included a translation by Ben Benani, another wonderful poet, of a Mahmoud Darwish poem called The Prison Cell. And I've seen what this poem does to American teachers, and that has been very interesting to me because, you know, American teachers who may not be that, that steeped in the Palestinian sorrow or the details of the story, they so often come to me about this poem and say, you know, read this poem when you come to our students, because it relates to so many things. You know, our Mexican-American immigrant students, our African-American students. This poem is for all of us. We want to hear this poem. So here it is, a Mahmoud Darwish poem called The Prison Cell. And by the way, Mahmoud told me, when you put that poem in your book, I was glad because I actually had forgotten all about that poem. I had forgotten I ever wrote it. So here it is, The Prison Cell. It is possible. It is possible at least sometimes. It is possible, especially now, to ride a horse inside a prison cell and run away. It is possible for prison walls to disappear, for the cell to become a distant land without frontiers. What did you do with the walls? I gave them back to the rocks. And what did you do with the ceiling? I turned it into a saddle. And your chain? I turned it into a pencil. The prison guard got angry. He put an end to the dialogue. He said he didn't care for poetry and bolted the door of my cell. He came back to see me in the morning, shouting, "Where did all this water come from?" I brought it from the Nile. And the trees? From the orchards of Damascus. And the music? From my heartbeat. The prison guard got mad. He put an end to my dialogue. He said he didn't like my poetry and bolted the door of my cell. But he returned in the evening. Where did this moon come from? From the nights of Baghdad. And the wine? From the vineyards of Algiers. And this freedom? From the chain you tied me with last night. The prison guard grew so sad, he begged me to give him back his freedom. That's Mahmoud Darwish, The Prison Cell.
Wow, that is an amazing.
It's an amazing poem.
I've never heard that one.
No, it's a kind of a rare poem, and I'm happy to say that it's a poem which Patrick Lannan of the Lannan Foundation particularly liked, and he ended up giving only a few years ago a huge award to Mahmoud Darwish, which I will always be grateful to remember that event, because the Lannan Foundation gave Mahmoud Darwish the Cultural Freedom Award, which is one of the highest monetary awards that can be given to any writer. And Darwish came to Philadelphia to accept it, and the wonderful poet Carolyn Forché, who loves his work, and I were asked to read his poems in English, and he read only in Arabic, and the fabulous Marcel Khalifa, whom I adore, came and sang Darwish poems that he had set to music, and it was an amazing night, but that was a poem that I wanted to read that night because I knew that Patrick Lannan had liked it. It's an amazing poem. It really does speak for all of the many situations which are unfair.
Absolutely.
And as we know, Darwish was jailed many times in his own life and lived in exile many years of his life. So, you know, it's quite traumatic to me that he died here in my state of Texas too. I hate that. I was very, very shocked when I heard that he had died in Houston. And
I'll tell you, I think it was so sudden for everybody. I mean, he was not an older man.
No, he was young and vital.
Absolutely, and for him to die so suddenly like that was, I think it impacted everyone in the world. I know it certainly impacted myself and the community here in Michigan.
Yes.
You probably know some of my... I believe, weren't you at the Arab American Museum at a reading at one time?
Yes, I love the Arab American Museum. I was there for the Rawi Convention, the Radius of Arab American Writers. I hope everyone who hears our program will join up. R-A-W-I, please join our group. It's a wonderful group, and we meet every 2 years, and the last time we met was at the Arab American Museum.
I was out of town at the time, and my friend Anan Amri, who is the director of the museum.
Oh, yes, I love her.
She's wonderful.
She's a wonderful person.
Yes. She's so
what
proud
a champion.
Of the museum. What an incredible job she has done.
Yes, as she should be. It's a fantastic museum, and we all love it, and it's very important to have that museum now. And, you know, I will. Speaking of Mahmoud's death in Texas, one of his last translators, the great Fadi Juda, the Palestinian-American poet who recently won the Yale Prize for Younger Poets, and who was Darwish's, one of his last translators, and translated the beautiful book called The Butterfly's Burden. Fadi is also a doctor, and he got to be with Mahmoud a few days before his death, or maybe even on the day of his death, I'm not sure, in Houston, because that's where he lives. And that is some comfort to me, knowing that Darwish was with not only a couple of his own friends who had come with him, but with Fadi, who loves him so much.
You know, we have a question from one of our listeners. Mike in California wants to know, did you attend a memorial for Mahmoud Darwish in Texas, or one in Palestine, and if so, what was it like? How many people were there?
Yes, no, I apologize, Mike. I did not attend it. In Texas, I think they still haven't quite had one. I may get to attend a forthcoming event that's being considered for the Rothko Chapel in Houston, and I'm going to try to go to that if I'm able. But I heard there were many, many people in Ramallah, your hometown, there, and I read an account written by Marcel Khalifa, who was there online, and I saw some YouTube footage of the memorial, and I think, you know, thousands of people showed up. So his mother, who attended, had a great deal of support. I believe she attended, but anyway, if she didn't, if she was not able to attend, at least she knows that thousands of people came to spread their love for her son.
Naomi, you're kind of in a conclusion because there's so much more I have to talk to you about. How do you think Mahmoud Darwish impacted the struggle of Palestinians for freedom and self-determination, the Palestinians themselves?
Well, I would think that Darwish was critical because I think having a voice that is like a lighthouse beacon for your people and their struggle and their sorrow is very, very important. It gives you something to keep looking at. It gives you energy. It gives you belief. It gives you hope. It gives you a song. It gives you a sense that you are not alone. And I think whenever you read his poems and feel, you know, the eloquence of his language, his profound ability to speak in a collective way, which is not an easy thing to do effectively as he did, you feel that sense of the family of people in this struggle, in this sadness. And so, you know, I think he fortified people's hearts. He gave them light. He shone a light. He helped them in the darkness. And there has been so much darkness. And, you know, when you are a people who are considered unchosen by more than one government, you need poetry. And you need voices which believe in your struggle and believe that you have a right to be human beings as well.
I have, let me see, we're getting in some questions already from our listeners. Ariel in Florida, I read your bio. What was it like to be on with Bill Moyers? Is he as perceptive and thoughtful as he appears on television? And before you answer that, while you think about that, I just want everyone to know that among her many honors, Naomi Shihab Nye is the recipient of 4 Pushcart Prizes, 2 Jane Addams Children's Books Awards, the Patterson Poetry Prize, and the Levan Award from the Academy of American Poets. Her works, Different Ways to Pray and Hugging the Jukebox, won the Vortman Poetry Prize. She's also been a Guggenheim Fellow, a Witter-Biner Fellow, a Lennon Fellow, and a National Book Award finalist. Her books, Hugging the Jukebox and The Same Sky, have been selected as worthy by the American Library Association. So we have amongst us a really astoundingly talented woman. Thank you for being here. Now, as to Bill Moyers...
Well, you're sweet to say all those things. I'm just a very common and often lazy person here in downtown Old World, Texas. Bill Moyers is even better than he seems on television. He is a tremendously, and thank you, Ariel, for that kind question. I appreciate it on his behalf. He is a Texan that we are very, very proud of. As you know, there are some Texans we're not so proud of, but he is someone I always bring up because to me he represents the kindly, generous spirit, which is also indigenous to this part of the world, and he is thoughtful, he is so intelligent, so well-read, he has enormous compassion and empathy for people on all sides of many issues, and he has a tremendous ability to listen and to make other people feel interesting, as if you do have something good to say. I think he has a tremendous gift with that, I think he's one of my personal heroes. So I can definitely say that Bill Moyers is even better in real life than he seems on the air. And I watch his programs for the sustenance we need in these conflicted times.
You know, you said something just now that triggered a thought in my mind. Many years ago, I'm a fan of Orwellian philosophy, so to speak. And when I was reading some of Orwell's articles once, I read that he believed that all writers were basically lazy.
Oh, that's funny.
And when you
I'm glad you said that. That helps me. Maybe I should write that in my journal. It's a worry I have. It's definitely a worry I have. That's very nice. Thank you for quoting that. I want to tell one more thing about Bill Moyers. Last year, my husband and I were in a small town in East Texas near the town of Marshall, where Bill Moyers grew up. And we went into an amazing bookstore in an old house, one of those bookstores where you have to paw through the stacks and find all kinds of treasures. And there was a very, very wonderful elderly gentleman running this bookstore, and I said, sir, did you know Bill Moyers by any chance? Because this man had told us he had been in that part of Texas all his life, and he said, are you kidding? I knew him since he was a boy. I always called him the boy wonder. And I thought that was great. So I wrote to Bill, and I said, I met the man who calls you the boy wonder. I just thought that was really sweet.
Honeybee. I can't, and I told you this before we got on air, I can't tell you how many ways Honeybee spoke to me. One of the ways was in communication skills. Actually, you were wonderful, and believe it or not, communication skills helped me to make a decision about something. And I'll read the first verse, and it says, I'm working on speaking to the ones who haven't spoken to us in years, the ones swinging punches out of nowhere, the ones who decided to shun us for reasons unknown, who wouldn't greet our group at the family reunion but sat across the swimming pool looking wounded. I absolutely, as soon as I have been in a dilemma, believe it or not, Naomi, over.
I think we all are. You know, I think it's something in every life, maybe.
And when I read that, I thought, oh, my God, this book is here to tell me something. And so many parts of this book spoke to me in so many ways. And I actually did make a decision. And we are going to the wedding that we were not going to go to.
That's great news. Thank you for telling me that. That's beautiful.
It was wonderful.
Well, you are so, so sweet to say that. And that means a lot to me. And actually, I made a really strong effort with someone this summer, and it worked out, and that made me happy, and it made me laugh just to think of communication skills, how a poem can continue, even if you wrote it yourself, it can continue to help you out, you know, in days to come. But I think it's pretty universal. You know, everyone I meet has someone they care about who won't speak to them, or, you know, someone who, you know, I'm going to punish you by never speaking to you again. It's kind of a common thing, and you think, boy, we talk all the time about, you know, governments not getting along, and everybody has some, you know, basic work they can do in their own lives, and we're always doing it. We're always trying anyway.
Well, some of these are just wonderful. My president went quail hunting.
Yeah, that was true. You know, it was a true poem. Thanks. I'm glad you liked it.
Amazing. People who study quails describe I think the part that is so interesting is there are many things my president might have done after months of killing and sorrow, but he chose to take a gun into the fields. I think that just speaks so loudly as to what some of the decisions that have been made by this administration. It's just
yes.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Well, thank you. I agree. And, you know, the whole idea of working for peace by sending warriors and weapons is so ridiculous. It sort of reminds me of some of the Sarah Palin commentaries going around, but something I thought immediately when I read a little bit about her was, you know, how can anybody be pro-life and pro-hunting in the same breath? It just is very counterintuitive to me. It doesn't make sense.
Well, in fact, it doesn't make sense. We have a question from Jack in Idaho, and he asks, considering your background and stance on Palestinian rights, which presidential candidate are you endorsing or voting for?
Well, I'm strongly, strongly endorsing Barack Obama with all my heart, even though I do not think that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is one that he has spoken in a way. Let me just say that I feel he's a very intelligent man, and I feel he can continue to be educated as a president, and even though he has spoken in a very strongly, you know, identifying himself with Israel way, which is fine. I'm not anti the existence of Israel. I mean, it's there now. You got to be a realist. You got to say it's there. What are we going to do? We got to work together. I think he can be educated, and I think he will find a way to know more and be more balanced if he gets elected. I hope so. I am not proud of the way he has spoken before now. It's the one issue I felt personally disappointed in him about. But all the other issues, I go with him on. I urge anyone who feels very depressed about, you know, politicians can never stand up for the Palestinians to see the incredible documentary Jimmy Carter, Man of Plains, which heals my heart every time I even think about it. It's the story of when his book about the Palestinian issues came out, and he went on a book tour, and many things that happened. And it's a story of true witness. And I urge anyone, you know, who feels like no one ever stands up for the Palestinians to see that movie. Get it wherever you can. Jimmy Carter, Man of Plains. It will make you feel better.
Well, you heard it from a fantastic author. Culture of Life. George W. Bush believes in a culture of life. This is very interesting to those who have recently died because of his decisions. They discuss it regularly. What could they have done differently to be alive? If only they had been born in another country or lived in a different neighborhood, the culture might have included them too. Actually, they liked life a lot. They can't stop thinking about their teacups and blankets and the scent of sheep wool in a warm room. Click of almond shells in a bowl, that simple coming home feeling when someone happy to see you greets you. Never mind, they have imagined being dead and thinking about teacups. Culture of life, wow. Absolutely,
well, you know,
totally a dichotomy.
It's really, really painful when you keep hearing all these politicians talk about, you know, the American dead, and they don't include so many innocent Iraqi dead, and it's just, it's so insulting. It wouldn't take anything away from the American dead to acknowledge how many Iraqis have also lost their lives. And George Bush did use that phrase a lot, culture of life, in the first years of his presidency. I don't know, he may have given it up by now. And it just seemed so fake, so hollow, the more people who died. And so presumptuous, too. As if culture of your life, but what about all these other lives that you're not even counting? What about the American soldiers whose coffins we can't even see? What about the veterans who can't even get the help they need? You know, I live in a city here where San Antonio has the Center for the Intrepid for helping soldiers who were wounded in battle in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it had to be paid for by private funds. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of questions you could ask about the culture of life. And hopefully Americans keep asking them and stop biting down on these ridiculous kind of notions that might be comfy if they were true about the good guys and the patriotism and the righteousness, which is so hollow for so many people.
Even when you speak it, hollow, just it does, it rings so hollow. Louise in Washington, Naomi, asks, what do you feel is the solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, I used to believe in the two-state solution, but the brilliant Edward Said, 1,000 times smarter than I will ever be, believed in the one-state solution and talked personally to my father and me about that. And my father and I talked about it for years, and I think we both have came to the opinion that Palestinian and Jewish people need to find a way to live together because the land mass is too small really to be split in an effective way. I mean, even when you think about transporting vegetables and roads and all the mess that's been done with the land as it now stands, and I urge everybody to read the Rajesh Shahada book called Palestinian Walks, which is very, very profound and touching. And it talks about, you know, all the changes of the land mass itself. But I really think following the model of the Seeds of Peace camp that camps that Palestinian and Israeli people, who are cousins after all, should be able to figure out a way to live in a state together. Now, many people say, well, that'll never happen because the Jewish people don't want Palestinian people to, you know, have any voice in the government. Well, I think, as my father said before he died, at a certain point, people are going to be so exhausted from fighting, they're just going to have to realize, you know, we really have to make a leap here. I'm a big fan of Sari Nusseibeh, and urge people to read his book, Once Upon a Country. And I think, you know, any of us who have close, you know, I don't know any Arabs in the United States who don't have very close Jewish friends. And we get together and we all talk about how this could be, and I think it could be. So that's my hope, that the exhaustion with fighting and with dominating and with being the best or being the dominant culture will somehow give way to a collaborative culture in which people share their strengths. I mean, when you think about it, wouldn't that be incredible, Jewish people and Arab people sharing their strengths in a profound little land that has so much history and so much, you know, just so much resonance in it. I guess at this point it's the only thing that makes sense to me. I hate the wall. I hate the wall with all my heart. I think it has to come down. I think it needs to be transported to New Orleans to make that levee higher. I hate the wall, the fence, whatever it is, between Texas and Mexico. We hate that fence wall thing also over here. That could also be transported to New Orleans. You know, it's so weird how the places where we need walls and fences, nobody ever seems to be able to build them high enough, and the places where we don't want them, they're going up. It's crazy.
That is wonderful. I absolutely love that. Yeah, we can do that. I'm
yeah, let's move that wall.
Let's move the wall to New Orleans.
Yeah.
Letters my prez is not sending. Dear Rafik, sorry about the soccer game you won't be attending, since now you have no. Dear Fauzia, you know, I have a mom, too, so I can imagine what you. Dear Shadia, think about your father versus democracy. I'll bet you'd pick. No, Sammy, that's not true, what you said at the rally, that our country hates you. We really support your move toward freedom. That's why we no longer have a house, or a family, or a village. This poem, and it goes on. I could, you know, I if you had it, I wish you could read the rest in your own words, because I just think this is just an amazing.
Yeah, poem. I have it right here. Dear Hassan, if only you could see the bigger picture. Dear Mary, I'm surprised you have what we would call a Christian name, since you yourself. Dear Rabia, sorry about that heart attack. I know it must have been rough to live your entire life under occupation. We're sending a few more bombs over now to fortify your oppressors, but someday we hope for peace in the region. Sorry you won't be there to see it. Dear Suher, surely a voice is made to be raised. Don't you see we are speaking for your own interests? Dear Sharif, violence is wrong unless we are using it. Why doesn't that make sense? Dear Nadia, I did not know about your special drawer. You know, I like to keep a few things, too, that have meaning to me. Dear Ramsey, you really need to stop crying now and go on about your business. Dear Dado, I know 5 kids must feel like a lot to lose in one swoop, but we can't stop our efforts. Dear Fatima, of course I have feelings for your own people. My college roommate was from Lebanon. Dear Mahmoud, I wish I had time to answer your letter, but you must understand the mail has really been stacking up. So that was letters my prez, P-R-E-Z, is not sending. You know, we all know George W. Bush likes nicknames, so I thought, well, I can give him one too, prez. And, you know, maybe it's very presumptuous to speak for one's president, but he pretends to be speaking for us a lot of the time, and we might want to argue with what he says. So I thought, let's balance this out a little bit, and let me dream up a few letters that he's not sending. And I'm really sorry he's not.
I'm really sorry he's not too, and I'm just praying that the next administration will be sending letters like that. Talk to us about some of your new work, Naomi. Before you do that, could you read me one poem? Now, this book is called Honeybee. And in the beginning it says, honey, beeswax, pollinate, hive, colony, work, dance, communicate, industrious, buzz, sting, cooperate. Where would we be without them? Where would we be without one another? Can you read me one poem that you think it describes why you chose the honeybee as the title?
The honeybee image, yeah, sure. You're so sweet. That what you just read was written by my fabulous editor, Virginia Duncan. She writes the flap copy for my books, so I can't take credit for it. But, it's a little bit of a strange book, I think, Honeybee, because I'm very, very worried about honeybees and following, you know, the stories in the last few years about their disappearance, the enormous number of honeybees that are disappearing in many countries, not just the United States, and all of the reasons for their disappearance and all of the theories and studies that are being done on them. But also, you know, one of the theories is this thing called colony collapse disorder. And that seems like a very interesting parallel image, a scary one, but interesting, for what goes on with human beings in times of war. It's like our little colonies collapse and people don't behave in normal ways, people can't, you know, do normal little things, and even if we're at a distance, but we know that somehow we're paying for a war we don't believe in, it's like something in our spirits keeps collapsing because it's very, very frustrating. So anyway, my husband and I were hosting one of our dear nieces who lives in Australia, and she told me that she had just graduated college in Australia, and she said that before the students in her class could graduate, they all had a collective assignment. No matter what your major was, you had to read the blog of an Iraqi citizen and write about it. Well, it just seemed amazing to me that these Australians are so wise. You know, talk about reaching out for the other. Talk about extending your students' views right before they graduate. Anyway, so I said to my niece, who did you read? She said, I read Sunshine. At that time, I think she was 13. Now she's maybe 15. So I became addicted to reading Sunshine. And I urge everyone who's listening to this broadcast to look up Sunshine Blog Iraq. And it's called Days of Our Lives. And she's an amazing young woman who's been keeping a blog through these years of war. But I wrote a poem thinking about how, you know, this young woman loves school. She loves her friends. She loves taking tests. She loves studying. And she's been trying to continue doing these normal teenage things in the midst of a catastrophic situation over there. And so I wrote this poem kind of imagining someone like her. Someone you will not meet. Rolls her socks into balls, lines them in a shoebox, sharpens a yellow pencil, carefully checking the point. There used to be plenty of pencils. Stares into a mirror thinking, fat nose, fat nose. Pins a green bow to her head, plucks it off again. Worries about loud noises. Wraps presents in the same crumpled paper over and over again for members of her own family. Gives her brother an orange because he likes them more than she does. He complains, I am sick of this life. She fusses, don't say that. Gives her mother a handwritten booklet made of folded papers called One Apartment. The people she loves most are in it. The uncles who come and go are in it. Lucky ducks. They are afraid every time they go, but they brave it. A few cats and plants and rugs are in it, square television set with a scrappy picture, and the streams of bees swooping to the jasmine vine right outside the window. They dip into blossoms and fly away. Never could she have imagined being jealous of a bee. She listens to the radio say there will be more fighting, though no one she knows likes fighting. Does anyone feel happy after fighting? It's a mystery. She chews on a sesame cookie very, very slowly. Staring at the sesame seeds, She could almost give them names. So somehow this book ended up being a book about, you know, honeybees and war and children and our daily lives and people who feel like they don't have enough time to do what they really want to do and claiming the time and trying to, you know, witness many things at once. I really have to praise my editor, Virginia Duncan, because she had more faith than I did that this stuff could possibly be a book, you know, put together.
Well, and, you did a brilliant job. And, you know, at first I wasn't sure. I'm thinking honeybee. And when I started reading the beginning about the story about your niece and writing about all of these things and reading the blogs, and I thought, okay, where is this leading? I don't know how she's going to put this together, but it's
yeah, that was always my question too. And I urge your readers to write with that sort of I don't know what would I call it, recklessness, flamboyance, something that people who've been writing all their lives, you know, get kind of used to. But I think many times I meet people who want to write, but they're afraid because they're not sure how these wild bits and pieces could possibly, you know, come together in any way. But I think, you know, as writers, we can take some comfort in the fact that the more you write, the more you realize things can happen that you could not have predicted. So it's not always a predictable devotion, occupation. It's something that you have to keep exploring. And so, you know, writing about things you really care about and different issues in the world, even if they seem as dissimilar as honeybees and war, there may be some mysterious kind of parallel that comes along. And I think that happens for many of us when we write.
Well, I absolutely, there is one poem, I'll save that one till the end of the interview before I allow you to read it to me again, because it's just wonderful. John from the Canadian Rockies, Naomi. Have you seen the Canadian television program, season 2, in parentheses, Little Mosque on the Prairie? If so, what do you think of it? If not, this is a heads up. Enjoy.
Well, I have not seen it, and I have read wonderful things about it, and I want to see it, and I'm going to have to figure out, you know, some way to order it or get a hold of it. Thank you very much for that heads up on it. My son's living in Canada. My son's in Canada right now. I'll tell him to check it out.
Oh, great. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure
that
he'll give you an interesting take on it.
Yes, I will definitely try to find it. Pardon?
What kind of work are you doing? What are your works?
Right now I'm working on a picture book that is set. It takes place in Muscat, the wonderful town of Muscat, Oman, where I visited this year and worked in a fantastic school called the American International School of Muscat, one of the most wonderful schools I've ever visited. But I had actually wanted to go to Oman since I was a child. It had been a very intriguing place to me. And so I'm working on a picture book set there with a boy who's getting ready to leave Oman and come to the United States. His parents are going to go to graduate school, and he's going to go to kindergarten. And I actually met quite a few Omani people who had done this, who had come to the U.S. or Canada or England or somewhere else and then gone back. And so this picture book is going into its fourth draft now, and I'm working on that. And then I'm working on a lot of poems and little tiny essays to my beloved father, Aziz Shihab, who died, as I said, 11 months ago. And before he died, he had mentioned many times wanting to do a book with me. And we tried different things. We emailed back and forth. I tried sending him questions. He would write me these monologues. It didn't quite work out. But I'm trying to work with some of the material and writing new poems to him about his life, his death. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. I was very lucky to have such a darling father. And so I'm working on that, and it's been very healing. I have a huge stack of his journals, which I hope to type from. I haven't quite been able to do that yet, but I will be doing that soon and putting some of the things together. But so those are two things I'm working on, and I'm always working on poems and essays and, you know, political monologues at the moment.
<Very interesting. laughs>
Every day I get something,
you
know.
One of those.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, just stick with the pro-life, pro-hunting thing and keep asking questions. Hey, that doesn't go together. That's scary. That's more scary stuff.
I mean, really, it is such fodder for writers to indulge in when you hear this ambiguous form of thinking. I mean, it's just not clear. And I'm trying to figure, how are they doing this? How are they seeing such ridiculousness and getting away with it?
Well, I guess what scares me more is why is it popular to even half of our country? Who are these people? Where did they come from? What are they thinking? One thing I love about my candidate, Barack Obama, is his ability to be nuanced and to kind of look at the rounded possibilities of an issue and say, you know, well, this, but also this. And that's what reality is. And we can't, you know, this kind of, I'm clinging to my position and no one's going to push me off this pedestal, this kind of righteousness that people want to cling on to, it doesn't work out, you know? It just doesn't work out. So when I read Barack Obama's books and when I hear his speeches, and I admire him so much for writing his own words, you know, I think all writers admire him. I personally think that reading things that speechwriters write for you is really a ridiculous proposition too.
I think that
should be brought up more often. You know what? I mean,
well,
I think we should put it out there
before they actually say it in the public arena, which is, I think,
pretty
interesting in and of itself.
Absolutely, but I mean, shouldn't we all be admiring someone who can really think and put words together? And as the great writer Michael Ondaatje said about Barack Obama's books, you know, even if he weren't running for any political office, these are exquisite books. These are testimonies of human life. These are stories which, you know, invite us into their being and change us through the reading of them. And, you know, I think that is very important to keep bringing up. He thinks for himself. He writes for himself. He has a mind. He's not willing to stretch it and look at things. And he will stretch it about the Palestinians. I know he will. And I've heard. Yeah. What?
I get very concerned when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli issue. You know how deeply embedded all of the candidates tend to be with APEC in Washington, and it is something that we concern ourselves with.
Right, and it's very upsetting. I mean, you think, why can't there be an American politician who would say, I'm for justice in that region, and I will do everything in my power to help it along, but not favoring, you know, the good guys and the bad guys. And, you know, wouldn't that be amazing? Well, look at Jimmy Carter's books and look at Jimmy Carter, Man of Plains, the documentary, and feel better.
Yeah. Sherry in Michigan. Sherry is a dear friend of mine. Thank you, Sherry, for writing in. So many Palestinian American activists feel a sense of hopelessness as the situation on the ground deteriorates. How do you stay so motivated, she asks?
Well, because, you know, I do get very frustrated. And, Sherry, thank you for the question. And I guess now I have the feeling that I want to be motivated, you know, on behalf of my dad, who never got to see justice come, or Mahmoud Darwish, who spoke so long and so hard for everybody, or Edward Said, who was such a wise thinker and philosopher and gave us so many perspectives to look at. You know, if we just finally throw up our hands and say, okay, it didn't work, it failed, we lose, nothing will ever be better, well, we could do that, and I can certainly see how people could do that. But I keep thinking about resilience and beautiful book called Tasting the Sky by Ibtissam Barakat, which came out this past year for young readers. Ibtissam herself is a Palestinian refugee. She lives in Missouri. And she has this profound belief that through the telling of our stories, we can all somehow become more healed or more human or big enough to take into account someone else's story that isn't exactly matching up with yours. And you know, I know that everything on the ground doesn't give us a lot of hope, but I am a person who always kind of lived in my head and in stories and in the belief that we could get to know one another across a line or a wall. So I just hope there is enough energy, you know, enough strength I think we have to keep sending off our checks, you know, for Palestinian kids to buy their school supplies for the year or their, you know, get their medicines or, you know, just helping in all little ways that we can do. Now, these things are such drops in the bucket. You know, you send off your little checks regularly and think, oh, but it's nothing. It's just nothing. And, you know, well, there's every way to feel frustrated, but we have to keep holding up our heads for all the ones who have held theirs up in terrible times.
Well, you know, as a writer myself and a poet, I have a few of my poems that I consider to be favorites. Do you have a favorite poem? And if so, would you share that with
us? No, I don't have a favorite poem. I don't have a favorite, but since we've been talking, I can read a poem that a friend of mine told me was her favorite from a book called You and Yours.
Okay.
It's certainly not my favorite, but she said it was her favorite. And this was a line, it has a title that comes from a line spoken by an Israeli about the Palestinians. He said, I couldn't believe this, I never realized they had aspirations like ours. Cranes which land in a Texas river have flown for thousands of miles. Dipping long beaks into green water, they pretend not to notice us. Graceful necks, a curved, close world. Still, a feather fluffs or a wing stays wide if we pass. What else but the long stroke of hope? Some have said it 50 years. By now, the sorrowing people make secret refuge in the sky. If the ground satisfied their dreams, the sky would miss them.
Wow.
I do hope the ground satisfies their dreams more, though, in days to come. I mean, why not? Anybody look at the websites of the dialogues of Palestinians and Israelis, you know, all these great projects that bring people together, look at the Seeds of Peace, look at the One Voice website. There are so many groups doing positive work. And years ago, there was that amazing Benetton catalog that, you know, kind of disappeared. But to me, it's one of my favorite documents where it had the word enemies on the cover, and it had a beautiful woman and a beautiful man kissing, and it turned out one of them was Israeli and one was Palestinian. And then when you went through the whole catalog, which was allegedly a clothing catalog, although the clothes were not the things you really noticed, on every single page there was a Palestinian and an Israeli telling how they became friends. And this, to me, was my favorite document. I carried mine around. It may have crumbled by now. And I really think that there have to be enough people believing, you know, that better spirit. And it was quoted, one of the women in the book said, you know, I just always believed that thing. Peace is far too important to be left to politicians. You know, we have to do it ourselves. They're not doing it for us, so we have to keep doing it ourselves. And we have to hope that someday maybe politics catches up with us. You know, poetry can do it, art can do it, music can do it. Politicians are very slow to do it because there's a lot of greed and a lot of money and a lot of power and too many weapons. And
coming to a very close near an end to this lovely show, I think I have had a really wonderful time. And I know as a poet there is always this dilemma, and I've read a lot of renditions, poetic renditions of what they think about it. How do I know when a poem is finished? Could you read that to us, please?
Oh, yes. How do I know when a poem
page
is finished? Wait, I have to find it. 113.
Page 113 in Honeybee.
Okay, thank you. You are so sweet to ask me to read this. How do I know when a poem is finished? When you quietly close the door to a room, the room is not finished. It is resting, temporarily, glad to be without you for a while. Now it has time to gather its balls of gray dust, to pitch them from corner to corner. Now it seeps back into itself, unruffled and proud. Outlines grow firmer. When you return, You might move the stack of books, freshen the water for the roses. I think you could keep doing this forever, but the blue chair looks best with the red pillow, so you might as well leave it that way.
Absolutely wonderful. What a delightful.
You are so sweet. I hug you across the radio airwaves.
And I hug you, and I am looking forward to the next time you are in Michigan, and hopefully
thank
we
you.
Will.
I love Michigan.
It is a great place. I happen to love Michigan myself. Thank you, Naomi. It has been delightful having you. Again, our condolences to all of those who loved poetry and loved Mahmoud Darwish's work. He was the Palestinian national poet, and he deserved the honor. And Naomi, you have done him great justice. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I want everybody
to know.
Oh, you're welcome. Tomorrow, Brad Friedman of the Brad blog. That's another story. The Brad blog will guest at 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on the People Speak Radio Show. And next week, Naomi Klein. And I believe the week after that, Naomi Wolf. We have a month of Naomis here that are.
It sounds like a Naomi month. That's incredible.
Yes, it is.
That's absolutely crazy.
Wonderful women. I'm so thrilled to have you. Thank you so much, Naomi Shihab Nye. Good night, everyone.
Thank you. Good night.
We'll see you tomorrow night, folks.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island.